more narrow my world becomes, the more narrow my mind will be. If, in terms of modern philosophy, I have eliminated God and things in themselves from my mind, and limited myself to the very narrow world of my own inner experience, then indeed it will have an effect on me. In dealing with art, I referred to the fact that there is a difference between the artists of an earlier era and the post-1800 artists, the Romantics in particular. Whereas some of the earlier writers were men of the world, very competent men, still having elements of the old medieval artisan tradition, whereby they were not artists, supposedly inspired men, but in reality skilled in a particular area and businessmen who were in the marketplace to sell their skills. I think perhaps if we begin with an artist of the early modern era and then look at two or three that have come in more recent years to a position of prominence, we can see something of the difference. Let us look first, then, at Peter Paul Rubens. Peter Paul Rubens was quite a remarkable figure, an exceptionally fine painter, and at the same time, a diplomat of note, and a very competent businessman. He was a man who was equally at home in a court as a diplomat handling very delicate negotiations, in the business sphere negotiating, bargaining, and selling, and in his room at his easel painting. He was very much a man of the world. He was also a man of very great faith. When I say that, I must immediately hasten to add, do not confuse him with his father at this point, because sometimes people will come to me with a story about Rubens when, if I ever refer to him in speaking, confusing him with his father, who was also quite a notable figure. His father made the mistake, however, of having an affair with the Queen, which had temporary advantages and long-range disadvantages when the King found out about it. As a result of seeing what happened to his father, Peter Paul Rubens, on two grounds, one of cause and effect, and second, because he was a very devout Catholic, never was involved in all his lifetime in any illicit sexuality. Now, Rubens and his like, and painters, writers, sculptors in that earlier era, in the post-Renaissance, early Enlightenment era, had a down-to-earth, hard-headed businessman's outlook towards their work. They were still under the influence of the old artisan concept. But when we come to the 19th century, the artist suddenly is a very different character. The will to fiction in him is very great. And very often he confuses the real world and the world of his own mind. Let's deal very briefly with three different figures. First of all, Henry David Thoreau, whose dates are 1817-1862. Thoreau has had a very powerful influence on contemporary college youth, because they see him as one of their forefathers in the ecology movement. He's also had a profound influence because of his writings on civil disobedience. Thoreau's great work, published in 1854, was Walden, supposedly an account of his life out in the woods, living in nature, back to nature, and so on. In reality, it is a work of fiction. Now, such a scholar as Edo, who is by no means anti-Thoreau, speaks of it emphatically as a work of fiction pretending to be a documentary. All the while that he wrote this, Thoreau was actually only in the suburbs. The cabin that he describes in Walden was furnished from his parents' home. He was not supporting himself. He went home to eat from his parents' table morning, noon, and night. After all, he preferred mother's cooking to his own. And he was not, when he was not at his mother's table, he was dining with friends. During the daytime, he was not out foraging for himself in the wilds. He was in the local grocery store talking and gossiping with the town idlers. Thus he spent his entire day as a ne'er-do-well, as the town joke, more or less, the man who did not work, and whose book was highly ridiculous to the town folk, because if there was anything that Thoreau did not do, it was to go out and live on his own on the bounty of nature. As Edel says, and I quote, literary criticism, if it wished to treat Walden as a work of the imagination, might say that every poet lives in fancy rather than in fact. But literary history, unlike literary criticism, is in bondage to truth. And the truth is that Thoreau lived one kind of life and transformed it in his work into another, and then scolded his fellow men for not following his ideas. Like his mother, who often put on grand airs in the town, Chanticleer, that was Thoreau, crowed out of a world of make-believe, unquote. Now, of course, we would say that this is still a delightful work and a harmless work of fiction, but for the fact that the very ideas that are incorporated in Walden have become a part of our world outlook. Our history has been affected by it. We look back and we think about frontiersmen moving out and living off the wilderness, something that was never done. It required capital to go west. It required capital to come here. Or, as the immigrants who later came over, they had to work in the cities and capitalize in order to go west and to take advantage of the new lands. It was impossible to go west and take advantage of new lands without 2 years of capital. It required time to clear the land. It required funds to have seeds, to have farm equipment. And while you may say the farm equipment then was primitive compared to what we have now, it still required capital. And in terms of the income of the time, it was a considerable amount of capital. You had to have capital for seeds, for trees, fruit trees to plant, for whatever it was you were going to do, for cows, for chickens, and the like. Settlements were made by groups, and the groups moved out with capital. even the trappers did not live off the land. They were provided with food and equipment by the Hudson Bay Company or John Jacob Astor or whoever was behind them. The Indians who lived off the land regularly starved to death, and cannibalism was a basic factor on the North American scene outside of Mexico. The very word cannibal comes from North America. Originally, it was caribou from Caribbean, the Carib Indians. The fantasy that has been indulged in by historians has reached the point where, in one learned journal recently, by projecting modern statistical methods into the pre-Columbian past, an historian has posited that there were 20 million Indians in North America before Columbus came, so that, he says, consider the extent of the genocide we have committed. This, which appeared early this year in the William and Mary Quarterly, is now rapidly finding acceptance because the will to fiction, which so prevails, grabs on that readily. It fits the myth of the devastating destruction wrought by Americans, by capitalism, or whatever name you want to give to it, consistently over history. Now let us turn again to another writer, Walt Whitman. 1819 to 1892, the good gray poet, the greatest American poet, we are told. The rough-hewn figure who represents the poetry of the people coming out of nowhere and suddenly bursting into song. However, Walt Whitman had a long history before he became a poet. He worked for a lawyer, in a doctor's office, for a printer, he was a school teacher, then he was an editor. He was a highly bookish man. As a matter of fact, he found the man we know as Walt Whitman by reading George Sand, the French novelist. And George Sand, in her novels, had a figure that appeared a couple of times, of an illiterate peasant who went around spouting, in terms of natural inspiration, poetry. Poetry that welled out of his being, that expressed the common man, the spirit of democracy, the future humanity. Walt Whitman fell in love with his character and then promptly grew a beard, threw away his necktie, wore working man's clothes, and began to write Leaves of Grass. He was now the man of the people. Now, what I'm telling you is not original with me. It was documented back in the 30s when I was at the university by Shepherd. And Shepherd's book, Walt Whitman's Pose, gives extensive citations, quotations at length from George Sand's character, side by side with what Whitman had to say, and demonstrates, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that Walt Whitman was imitating this character and spouting the same kind of verbiage. When the book came out, I took it to some of my professors and actually loaned them my copy and said, "This is quite a remarkable book. Have you read it?" I was then a reader in the English department, and when the professor I was working for was not too sober, which was often, I would lecture for him too. I had one reaction from everyone to whom I gave the book. They handed it to me like that and said, "What difference does it make?" The same will to fiction that marked Walt Whitman marked them. Now, a third writer, D.H. Lawrence, 1885 to 1930. best known for Lady Chatterley's Lover. D.H. Lawrence was a man of very great personal incompetence, but like Whitman, he saw himself as a Christ figure. As a matter of fact, Walt Whitman actually trimmed his beard at one time and affected a pose that would make him look like Christ. And it did to a startling degree. It bore a resemblance to the traditional depiction of Christ. However, this proved to be an embarrassment to his followers, and that picture is rarely seen now in biographies of Whitman. But Lawrence saw himself emphatically as a Christ figure. He declared on one occasion to his disciples, "I am not a man. I am man." When he left England to come to Taos, New Mexico, D.H. Lawrence was so enamored of the fact that he was the modern Christ that he held a last supper for his disciples. And he asked them to follow him to America. And at a key point, when he realized there was some disagreement and someone apparently had undercut him, this was Middleton Murray, he turned to Murray and said that he had betrayed him. He was Judas to his Christ. And Middleton Murray said, "I'm afraid I have betrayed you, old chap." At that point, D.H. Lawrence was prepared to denounce Murray, but being a little far gone from the Last Supper that he had put on, instead, he threw up and then passed out face down. Lawrence, when he arrived in America, brought with him the stock of ideas that he had picked up from Madame Blavatsky, and he was now bent to further his natural inspiration by communion with nature. And because he had picked up certain ideas from his reading of ancient religions, he felt that while he did not use the word reincarnation, there were elements of past existences embodied in himself. And he could best realize this by communion with a cow. Now, this may sound fantastic, but he actually purchased a cow whom he named Susan and regularly went out to talk to the cow and have communion with the cow. And he came up with this statement, which he was so enamored with, that he put down in writing so that these immortal words would not be forgotten by future generations. As he gazed into Susan's eyes, he said, "Is not this my life, this throbbing of the bull's blood in my blood?" This he got out of his studies in Mithraism. I won't go any further into the waywardness of D.H. Lawrence, but I think I have said enough now to indicate that in modern art, there is an incredible ability at self-delusion. But it's not only in modern art. The will to fiction is a part of the modern scene, because man, having departed from any sense of a real knowledge of things in themselves or of God, and having defined real knowledge as something that only exists in his own real mind and has no correlation to outer reality, has indeed philosophically adopted a position of fiction. The world is will and imagination, according to Schopenhauer. Modern man has made it that. Now, as a consequence, something happened in modern civilization that was totally non-existent in all previous cultures. an appetite for fiction. We can say, of course, the printing press made this possible, and various forms of the communications media have made this possible. But having said that, we still have to say that these things could have been put to other uses as well, that there could be a more dominant thirst for the acquisition of knowledge. When we must say, however, that they have been put primarily to the providing of fiction to the masses. Those of you who are English majors know what a fantastic response the first novel in English by Samuel Richardson received. Overwhelming. The appetite was there. It had already existed. It was a part of the modern world. Before that, you had had a tremendous influence culturally of opera. It is difficult for us to imagine what heroic plays on the stage and opera, also on the stage, of course, had accomplished in the preceding generations. For us, opera today is beautiful for its music. We fail to realize the concepts that are there, which are so full-blown and overly dramatic and impossible, were once very real to the people who listened to them. They were part and parcel of the heroic play, wherein man saw himself as a god on earth and found it difficult to believe that anything was impossible for him. And therefore, he was capable of almost anything. I like to cite an earlier hint of this in a play by Chapman, who is a contemporary of Shakespeare. In his Bussy d'Ambois, one of the more important plays of the Elizabethan era, you have one of the first hints of the later heroic play. When Bussy d'Ambois, at the end of the play, is stabbed and begins to bleed to death, there's an amazing scene in which he shows total shock at the idea that he can die. It has never occurred to him that he can. And in terms of the context of the play, the scene is totally believable. Now, in the heroic plays, this kind of tie with reality, to a great extent, is shattered. The characters live in what we must call the world of their imagination. And as a result, people, through the stage and through opera, were conditioned for the novel. We're told in the last century how people waited for the boat to arrive in America so that they could read the latest installment of a Dickens novel as it appeared serially in magazines, and how there was a wave of weeping all over England when in the old curiosity shop, the issue of the magazine appeared in which little Nell died. And when the boat docked in America, there was a wave of weeping from coast to coast as they read of the death of little Nell. People were so caught up in a fictitious character that they could think of little else than the impact on their lives, on waiting to hear what had happened to little Nell. And so it was, as Dickens made his tour of this country, he was so favorably received because the real world was beginning to merge with the world of fiction. And people found themselves in fiction, were deeply and intensely involved in what went on in the world of fiction. You had the dime novels. You had magazines proliferating, and a tremendous emphasis in all of them, again, on fiction. Then, of course, radio and motion pictures. Again, catering tremendously to this appetite for fiction. The amount of fiction produced in every country in the Western world and now in the countries of Africa and Asia is enormous. The appetite for it does not cease. As a matter of fact, the appetite for fiction has been greatly increased since World War II by the invention of television. Now consider the social implications of television. It means that the average person today spends a few hours a day immersed in fiction. The housewife, even more. The soap operas, the movies in the afternoon, as well as the usual run of programs in the evening. A saturation with the world of fiction. Never before in all of history have more people been absorbed with non-reality, with fiction, than in our culture. Never before have they had a greater appetite for it. We cannot blame the invention of radio, printing, or television for this. We must say that these inventions then provided an appetite with a supply. More significant, we saw in the 1960s and will continue to see the practical social consequences of this will to fiction. How? With the invention of television, it meant that there was not only verbal now, but visual fiction available for children from their earliest days. And so the television set became mother's helper as a babysitter. Now those of us who grew up in the pre-television era and the pre-radio era, because that was easy to do if you were on a farm before electrification, can testify to the fact that both apart from work, the kind of inventive play and activity of children in those days is now gone. The literally hundreds of games that were commonplace when you had time to play have disappeared. And they are non-existent. Children have never heard of the kind of activity that was once commonplace. They have been babysat by television. Now, if you want to see a rerun of the old movies of the 20s and 30s and 40s, all you have to do is to look at the history of student activities in the 1960s. The old revolutionary mobs shown in the old movies, unkempt, shaggy, ragged and dirty. The revolutionary mobs appeared as the student generation of the 1960s. They were reenacting to a great degree the kind of thing they saw in the formative years of their childhood. The result has been that people expect history now to act in terms of the movies. The revolutionary mob in the movies storming the palace, and then a blissful and a happy end, the heroine and the hero hug, and everybody is singing and they're lifting their steins in a glad song. Paradise has arrived. The expectation of instant realization, instant paradise, the beginning of the 60s, President Kennedy spoke of the revolution of rising expectations. That revolution of rising expectations was deeply imbued by this will to fiction. And this will to fiction now is basic to our politics, basic to religious thinking, basic to one area of life after another. And its consequences are devastating. Never in all of history has there been a greater market for fiction in the mind of man, nor has man devoted more hours a day to the consumption of fiction. As a result, history has been moving in a rather peculiar course. The validation of society has increasingly moved in terms of an errant path. The validation of society in the medieval world was in terms of a hierarchy of values that began with God. And under God was the church, with the Pope at the head, and then the kings and nobles, and then the people. Now, with the Renaissance, this picture was shattered to a great degree, and God was more or less removed. But with the Reformation and Counter-Reformation, this picture was restored with variations. The Enlightenment, of course, removed the church from the scene. And the result was that you had God, but now with parentheses as an absolute landlord, validating the enlightened monarch, the philosopher king, who then ruled the people. So that the validation of society still had some relationship to the objective world. With the age of revolution that dawned with the French Revolution, the people remained, and underneath them the physical world. Validation was now in terms of certain ideas of justice and of right derived from nature or from the rights of man. But there was still an idea of some kind of validation out of the nature of things. But the idea of validation now has progressively disappeared, because what we have seen is the rise of positivism, of relativism, and side by side with these philosophical doctrines, the rise of this will to fiction. And so, validation now is increasingly in terms of the will to fiction. What is desirable for man? What do I want? What do I dream about? What are my aspirations? Validation in society, you see, has increasingly been derived from the will to fiction. And as a result, traditional theology, traditional economics, no longer can speak to modern man effectually, because validation is no longer from something objective, no longer from a hierarchy of values, no longer geared to reality, but is geared to the will to fiction. And man, in terms of validation, has moved from God to nothingness. Man has denied meaning to the universe, so that now man stands alone in an empty universe in his own mind. In a very real sense, modern man is past salvation, because he is without meaning. Salvation is from something to something. For the Christian, from sin to grace. But when all alternatives are nothing, or when all alternatives are equally fictitious, no salvation is possible until a concept of meaning returns. As a result, in this framework, as Reif, a contemporary scholar, in his The Triumph of the Therapeutic, Uses of Faith After Freud, has written, and I quote, "Where a family and nation once stood, or a church and party, there will be hospital and theater too, the normative institutions of the next culture. Religious man was born to be saved. Psychological man is born to be pleased. The difference was established long ago, when I believe theory of the ascetic lost precedence to one feels, the caveat of the therapeutic. And if the therapeutic is to win out, then surely the psychotherapist will be the secular spiritual guide." As indeed, we must add, he is rapidly becoming. As a matter of fact, with regard to the psychotherapist, Freud, as the first in this school, said there is no such thing as healing because there is no such thing as sickness. In a famous letter, which I quote in part in my study of Freud, there may be some copies here still available, that's a plug, commercial. What Freud wrote to a mother who asked if he could cure her son of homosexuality was that who was to say what sickness was? So he said, "We do not cure. What we give to people is an understanding so that they can live with themselves, so that they can accept themselves." Now, when courts today send a prisoner to an institution for a psychiatric training, this, in essence, is what they give them. Not a feeling that what they have done is wrong, but a course of psychotherapy whereby they can understand themselves and live with themselves. The modern temper, I think, has been very, very clearly summarized in a very influential book by a young man whom I referred to earlier, Michael Novak, one of the most influential on students of the 60s, voted at the end of the 60s the most popular man on the Stanford campus, now in an Eastern university. In a book published fairly recently, 2 or 3 years ago, Michael Novak, in The Experience of Nothingness, refuses to allow any reality, any meaning, even to himself. He writes, "I am not a self, never did possess a self. Do not have a permanent and indestructible identity, and have no special need to mourn its absence. The self has no pure identity, substance, or core of its own. It is constituted by activities in engagement with the world. There is no self over and apart from the world. There is only a self in the world, part of the world, in tension with the world, resistant to the world." In other words, there is only a relationship, an indefinable one. It would be better, although after so many centuries our language scarcely would allow it, to drop the expression self entirely, and to speak instead of a conscious world, or indeed a horizon. I am a conscious world. You see, the subject-object distinction is gone, so that there is simply a world, a conscious world, a horizon, a conscious, open-ended, protean structuring of a world. The world exists through my consciousness, and my consciousness through it, not two, but one in act. Novak goes on to speak of the ocean as myself. There is no ocean in itself, nor an I of myself. The subject-object relationship is destroyed. So it's the ocean as myself. And so he says, there is not an I and a you, only a we, which is my consciousness. And he writes, when you attend to me, you make me exist for you. Nothing, he says, has meaning. This is the starting point. The self, he still uses the term, is a recipient of stimuli in a darkened room. There is no meaning. We live in terms of myths. And therefore, we must self-consciously realize that we create a social fiction. We live in terms of that. It is neither good nor bad, nor can we condemn one nor another. His problem, of course, then is, which he faces at some length, how can he distinguish his myth and Hitler's myth? His answer is a feeble one. He recognizes that there is a kinship between himself and Hitler. He is honest enough to say they are both, in a very real sense, in the same camp. But he says, Hitler forced men to distinguish between the experience of nothingness, which is human and valid, and nihilism, which draws from that experience corrupting, inhumane, and indefensible conclusions, unquote. But he then has no basis to say why something is inhumane and corrupting, because by definition everything, including the humane and the corrupt, is a myth. And so his conclusion is, we must live by myths. We must choose our myths, recognize that they are they have no validity and are nothing more than myths. And so he says that, and here he echoes Tillich self-consciously, granted that I am empty, alone, without guise, direction, will, or obligations, how shall I live? In the nothingness, one has at least an opportunity to shape one's own identity, to create oneself, the courage to accept despair becomes the courage to be. Courage to be what? Novak cannot answer that. It will be a fiction, whatever it is. It will be nothingness in essence. But this, he says, is our choice. A self-conscious adoption of fiction as the only course for man. The consequence of such a philosophy is indeed a very deadly one. As Novak concludes his work, he wrestles with the problem. Man must believe that his myth is true, or he drops it. There must be a will to believe, even though it is a fiction. But he cannot answer that, because he says, by definition, we cannot ascribe truth to any myth. And thus, he has chosen a course of fiction, finds himself in a blind alley and insists that there is no other place because he certainly has no other place to go. Validation is lost. It has reduced itself to the will to fiction, and validation by fiction is an impossibility. Are there any questions now? Yes.
Yes, not many such people know that they consider brilliant.
I can't hear you. Could you speak up?
Well, how can such people, such as know that, be considered brilliant when the logical conclusion of their philosophy is either death or sheer impotence?
How can he be?
How can people such as he be considered brilliant?
How can he be considered brilliant? Well, he's not only considered brilliant, but he regards himself and is regarded by others as a leading Catholic theologian. I didn't mention that because I consider it such an insult to any Catholic. But some of the church press has brought out some of his books. They are brilliant in this respect. They have been logical in pursuing a line of philosophy to its conclusion. They are stupid in that they don't realize the futility of that whole philosophical tradition. But the appeal of Novak is enormous. Precisely because, you see, the will to fiction is so basic that when he speaks to college youth, his impact is tremendous. He is far more important than Charles Reich, The Greening of America, and Rozak, and some of the others, because the particular strand of thinking he represents epitomizes our present-day culture perhaps better than any. Yes.
Would you comment on the trend to the blood and gore and violence in the motion pictures and how that relates to the things that we've been discussing?
Yes. This is a theological question, really. I deal with it in one of the first chapters of The Politics of Guilt and Pity. Very briefly, it is this. Man needs atonement because he is a sinner. If he will not find atonement in Christ, he will find it either by sadistic activities, ascribing guilt to the other and punishing him, or through masochistic activities, self-punishment. A very brilliant book has been written on this by a Freudian psychoanalyst, Theodor Reich, Masochism in Modern Man. Now, his position is radically different from mine, but nonetheless, he has given a powerful picture of the significance of masochism. It is inescapable. Masochism and sadism, or sadomasochistic activities. You're going to put the guilt on someone, so you're going to find an innocent person or an innocent group of people that you're going to make the scapegoat. This is why, for example, anti-Semitism is a sadistic kind of activity. Anything that puts guilt on a group or a person, transferring it from yourself or from your group, is an evasion of a theological fact that I have sinned and done that which is evil in thy sight. Yes?
I'm just wondering, all week long here, I've been waiting. If you hadn't mentioned one name, maybe you could tell me your assessment of where you might put him or something you might say. Adam Weishaupt.
I don't think that he's a figure of any great significance, but he was one of the early figures who dreamed, as countless figures have, of playing God and of substituting a man-made plan for the control of all things for God's plan. There have been thousands of such, and there are thousands of them today, and it will not end until our whole philosophical tradition ends. Yes.
Reverend Rush Juni, I get a little bit of contradiction, and perhaps you can explain it to me. On the one hand, you talk about a theology of hope. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, we talk about a will to fiction, mm-hmm. and the modern man destroying himself, modern man ending up at nothingness. Could you, I'm wondering if one of the modern philosophers were here listening to you, what rebuttal he might have to you, because it seems contradictory, and perhaps you can help.
Yes. Now, first of all, remember I cited Sartre as saying that you need others to be happy. That if you're going to be an existentialist, you're alone. You're in your own being, and therefore unhappiness, anxiety, despair are necessary to the existentialist. So that, philosophically, they have put themselves in a bind here. On the other hand, there are those who are more in the theological tradition who've insisted, no, we are going to save the world. We're going to break out of this, and we are going to have a one world order which we will call God. So if we work hard enough, we will create this. We will break out of ourselves, and we will create a post-historical man who is no longer conscious of himself, who will be like the bees in the beehive or the ants in the anthill, you see. He will no longer be alienated. Alienation will be overcome. Alienation really amounts, in their thinking, to self-consciousness. I will not think of myself as an individual in this future order. I will only be a part of this vague consciousness, which will be humanity. Now, that's fiction, of course, but this is a part of their thinking. Yes?
Would you say without qualification that Walt Whitman, the phony, is not a very good poet?
I would say Walt Whitman occasionally wrote some lovely lines. I would say that in essence, his poetry is shot through with contradictions. A lot of it is just sheer verbiage. And basically, I must judge him in terms not only of form, but of content. His form is very often defective, and his content, by and large, is nonsense to me. So I think he is basically a minor poet who has had major significance. Now, another poet whom I feel is a minor poet who is major in his significance is Byron. If you go through Byron, you find that his poetry is really minor as far as its value as poetry is concerned. But his social significance, like Whitman's, is very great. He is important. Yes.
We find in many of the publications that come to our attention that already the modern theologians are using the expression postmodern man.
Yes.
And saying such things as postmodern man has long since rejected the supernatural, the divine, the miraculous,
yes,
the mystical. And that what we need now is a here and now theology to suit this postmodern man. Now, how would you differentiate between what you call the modern man and the postmodern man?
Yes. Postmodern man is one step further along to post-historical man. Post-historical man is man who has reached the anthill beehive stage in the utopian world of Marx and others, which is beyond history. There is no change. It is perpetually the same. Man has lost consciousness. Modern man is the sick, alienated figure who knows the world is out of joint, that capitalism has destroyed the world, and so on. Postmodern man is one stage beyond that, supposedly. Yes?
What is your opinion of Robert Frost?
My opinion of Robert Frost? Robert Frost has written some very charming and lovely poetry. He's in the tradition of the older New England poets. He's not entirely a modern figure, a 20th century figure, I should say. He's a modern figure, but not a 20th century figure, who is not a very important or outstanding thinker. He's more in the tradition of Whittier and Lowell and Holmes, representing their Unitarian, transcendentalist, liberal position. All the same, he's written several very charming pieces. Yes.
Reverend Rushdoony, I think I can see a link between your position and the existential position. I would really very much appreciate your comments on it. And I can only put it, oddly enough, in the form of imagery or symbolism, or, if you like, myth or fiction. And that is that taking the position that God is here and also here, that taking the position God is within me, the imagery that I'd like to suggest to you in a life of time is of a very still lake inside, which is undisturbed by the flotsam and jetsam of this kind of sargasso sea of fear that will hold me static. An old ship can sail in the sargasso sea. It's filled with seaweed, with superstition, with deadness, and also undisturbed by the hurricanes, which, oddly enough, in the real world, start in the Sargasso Sea and start way down there in the place called the Doldrums. And that, well, I'm imagining something within that is undisturbed by either fear or anger, and which in itself is nothing. But in this situation of having a very still surface, is capable of reflecting the sun. So that God's will, I am now able to see.
Well, in the existentialist position, you see, there is nothing except the inner autonomous realm. Nothing. Whereas for a Christian position, the primary and basic reality is God. And we are his creation. So that reality in the one realm is a very limited, narrow inner sphere. Now, the Christian perspective certainly does not eliminate the inner sphere. But that doesn't make it existential to recognize the reality of the inner sphere. But you simply put it in its context in a world and life view. Yes.
I very definitely can connect this will to fiction with our economic situation, with the will not to recognize inflation and what that means to our country and all of this. I would like you to extrapolate, if you would, and tell us where you see us going from a theological or philosophical point of view, both what you hope will happen and what may happen. I think it may be two different, you may have two different answers, you may not.
When you have the will to fiction, you're headed for the grave, personally and culturally, because you have lost touch with reality. You're a basket case, both as an individual and as a culture. We are thus at the end of the road for the modern era, the age of the state, or whatever you want to call it. Now, it can stagnate, it can go into a truly dark age for a considerable length of time, or it can be renewed very quickly as men abandon the myths and accept a totally different position, which I hope will be Christian faith, because I feel everything else is bankrupt now. So I'm very hopeful about the future, not the immediate future. And of course, I believe that the recognition of this bankruptcy is a growing one, that the events of the next decade or more will bring this recognition home to more and more people. Dr. Senholz concluded the other day by saying that the change would have to come in the ideas of men. I believe emphatically it will have to come there. And of course, I think I see hopeful signs.
Thank you very much.